Hi, everyone. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here on behalf of the Dark Energy Survey. I think you've seen DES pop up on a number of the slides and talks today and this week. Hopefully, I'll be able to get through some of a quick summary of how the many ways that DES has contributed without too much overlap. So without further ado, if you're not familiar with DCAM, it's a 570-megapixel camera on which the Dark Energy Survey was executed over the course of 5 years. It's essentially two surveys in one, a 5,000 square degree wide survey and a 330 square degree repeat observation transient discovery survey. It was executed over about 6 years and over 700 nights, discovered more than 25,000 transients. And in our first data release, we released 300 million galaxies and over 39,000 exposures. Okay, and those exposures in the wide field go out to a quad depth of roughly 24th magnitude. The nightly exposures in the supernova deep drilling fields go out to 24th and a half magnitude. And then when we stack those supernova deep drilling fields, we get out to even better than 26th, even 27th magnitude. Okay, so just a very quick demonstrative summary of how various DES probes have contributed to this tension discussion. Here's not all the DES probes, but just the ones so far that have contributed to the discussion, namely the discussion on the distance ladder and supernova systematics and selection effects, the inverse distance ladder and how the inverse distance ladder is affected by calibration and other systematics. Strong lensing, and we've discussed the need for more strong lensing statistics, and standard siren and dark siren statistics. And then, of course, we talked about cosmological models across a wide range of redshifts, and then we've talked about consistency with Planck. And so, obviously, I'm not going to be able to talk about all these arrows in the next 14 minutes or whatever. but for example, I won't be able to talk about the fact that our BAO constraints are consistent with the previous results, including BOSS, nor will I have the time to talk about the over 750 strong lens systems that have been discovered with DES and in a collaboration with STRIDES, and I think roughly about 5 time delay cosmography measurements. Nor will I be talking about the combined probes year one analysis and comparison with Planck in S8 and Omega Matter, namely because it actually doesn't pass our internal DES criteria for tension. If we want to add a new word to the vernacular, I think the official statement on DES is compatible with Planck. Okay, so I do want to dive into supernovae. I want to dive into a combination of weak lensing, clustering, BAO and D over H measurements, and then I just want to touch briefly upon the discovery of the binary neutron star, which of course we're proud of. Okay, so the DES supernova program, where does it fall in the landscape of high redshift rolling supernova surveys? Of course, you have the discovery here in 1997. You have this group of surveys that set out to discover large quantities of supernovae at high redshift, those being SDSS, SNLS, and PanSTARRS. And of course, you know those from the JLA analysis and the Pantheon analysis, and many of those were used in the shoes. And you have LSST over here, and so DES slots in very nicely, bridging us to LSST. And what I mean by that is effectively, in these Pantheon survey, the surveys that are included in Pantheon, you have roughly 2,500 likely type 1A supernovae out to redshift, basically one. And we're going to double that. We have the data. We think we have roughly 2,500 likely type 1A supernovae out to redshift 1.2. Not only are we going to double the statistics, but our constraints on distance are and of course that's the name of the game here, uncertainty and distance as a function of redshift, are better than any of these previous surveys that are currently being analyzed. That is, the solid curves here are the DES fields, uncertainty on distance, the dots of the supernovae themselves, and then you can compare them to the dotted curves that were used in Pantheon. And so, excited by that constraint on distance, we set out to do a preliminary analysis of just roughly 300 supernovae, shown here, combined with low redshift supernovae, sample, and this is our Hubble diagram. We set out to investigate 74 sources of systematic uncertainty. We, at the end of the day, get a W consistent with -1 when combining with Planck. Those sources of systematic uncertainty are dominated by the calibration of the fluxes, the absolute fluxes. They're dominated by intrinsic models of intrinsic scatter and parent populations of the type 1a supernovae themselves, and modeling of the astrophysics. And we also include uncertainties due to how well we've modeled our own survey, and also motivated by TAMRA, as we heard earlier this week, uncertainties in redshifts, and we propagate an uncertainty in the spectroscopic redshift of 10 to the minus 5 that corresponds to roughly 0.5% uncertainty on W. W-naught WA, these are our results in purple, and for comparison, I'm showing the Pantheon result for time-varying dark energy. So you can see here, just using our 300 supernovae, we're quite competitive with Pantheon. Of course, not better, but we are certainly excited for the future of DES. And so we get a WA consistent with zero, and this marks the most powerful constraint on dark energy models per supernova to date. Another claim to fame we have as the DES collaboration is we call ourselves the first single photometric probe, single photometric system to rule out a no dark energy universe. So that's shown here in the gray. So if we ignore this low redshift sample altogether, we just look at our DES supernovae combined with weak lensing and 3x2 point and photometric BAO measurements, we get this value for W. You'll also notice that if we just take the DES supernovae and combine it with Planck 2016, we get a measurement of roughly 9% uncertainty, which is pretty comparable to the DES combined probes analysis. So it's just showing the strength of how when DES combines all of its methods, it can be comparable to Planck, and certainly going forward, it's going to be hopefully stronger. Okay, so we've talked about W and dark energy. Let's talk about systematics. So the first systematic I want to tackle is associated with the calibration of supernovae. That is the method by which supernovae were calibrated in the supercal process. That is how SHU's calibrated low redshift supernovae to lower redshift supernovae. We use the same process, but we are calibrating our low redshift supernovae to the high redshift supernovae. We perform an independent cross-check of this process. We observe in the same fields largely as PanSTARRS and SDSS, and so we can compare our calculated magnitudes between the surveys and between the SDSS shown in yellow and PanSTARRS in green. And those dots don't have the supercal offsets applied to them. But then we take those points and then say, okay, if we apply the offsets to them, that's the red line. And so the red line, encapsulated by the gray statistical uncertainty in our measurement of the calibration, is consistent with zero, meaning that our calibration of our camera is consistent with the supercal calibration. Okay, I want to dive into the discussion of the host environments. This will be sort of a cursory discussion of the host environments. I think Dave Jones is going to be talking more in depth about that later, but I do want to talk about our result specifically for the correlation between standardized supernova luminosity and the host galaxy mass. So this was seen by a number of studies to varying degrees, Hicken, Sullivan, Conley, and here in JLA you can see the step function in the Hubble residual as a function of mass, and here it is for our data set. So in the three-year analysis that I showed you, this is what we get, so a much weaker correlation, 0.01 plus or minus 0.02 roughly. But what I will say is that that's not to say that we don't see any correlation between the supernova and the host environments. We do see these correlations in the light curve fit parameters. And this has been seen extensively in previous analyses. So we have confidence in this result because we see it here. It's just that after doing the SALT II light curve corrections, we end up with no residual in the Hubble diagram. Also important to note, if this effect is weaker than what was used to correct for in JLA or what was used to correct for in SHUs, removing it or reducing it would actually raise the value of H not inferred by shoes.
By how much?
A
half a percent.
Yeah, yes, relatively small. Okay, the inverse distance ladder method. So this is not a novel technique. This was first done by Auberg and then done again with the Pantheon sample. This is just us swapping in our DES supernovae, and we get a consistent result. This is calibrating the supernova absolute brightnesses to the BAO distance scale, which is itself calibrated by the sound horizon.
Where do you get your sound horizon from?
The CMB, yes. Yeah.
From Planck?
Yes, from Planck. So we get a low value for H0, and this is exactly what has been seen by these previous techniques. But what we are proud of is, for the first time, we've done a full systematics budget analysis of this technique to see what it would take to get a higher H0, and we just can't get there, especially, even though we're dominated by the calibration, which, in fact, we aren't necessarily dominated by the calibration in our measurement of W, but in our measurement of this inverse distance ladder H0, it is dominated by the calibration, relative calibration between DS and the low Z sample. Namely because when you change the calibration here, it directly results in a change in H. Yet another confirmation of that method. Okay, weak lensing, clustering, BAO, BBN, that's this point here that we saw in the paper on Friday, which is you can consider to be an independent measurement of Planck with one no exceptions. So just a quick reminder, the BAO observable is D calibrated by RS, and so that is dependent fundamentally on the cosmological parameters omega matter, omega baryons in the early universe, and H. So if we use the BBN measurements from the deuterium abundance to constrain omega B in the early universe, assuming that we know the temperature of the CMB, from Kobe Firas, we can break that one of those degeneracies, and we're left with an omega matter H degeneracy. So that's this galaxy BAO plus BBN degeneracy between H and omega matter. This was you've seen this plot already by Graham Addison, who's been a vocal proponent of this method. But in Graham Addison's plot, you saw a curve like that with the Lyman alpha BAO, and he said, you may have caveats about systematics associated with this measurement, and maybe you'd be worried that because these curves don't agree as well, you're left with a very small region of parameter space that is acceptable. But when we swap out the Lyman alpha BAO for the DES weak lensing constraints on omega matter, we get a very similar result. Okay. Just going on through, here we go. So the discovery of the first kilonova, that was really fun for us. This is a collaboration led by Marcelli Suarez Santos. We call it the DESGW program. We are considered a co-discoverer. I think there are other co-discoverers in the room. I don't want to leave them out. But it's a good thing they told me not to swear, because this, of course, was the only appropriate reaction to seeing that image. And with that, we were able to make a measurement of H0, which we talked about earlier today. I'm not going to show that plot again, but I will just dive briefly into how we did the modeling of the kilonova itself and how we improved the constraints on that one H0 measurement. Of course, with the caveats that this is introducing serious astrophysics, potentially systematic uncertainties. We did not do a systematic uncertainty analysis here. I like to think of it as what's the best we could do at the time, given that it was shortly after the SHOES 2016, sort of renewal of the tension, maybe before some of these, I think we're at tens of probes now that have matured. So there was a lot of excitement to see how well we could do with this one measurement. So this was our attempt to do that. Reminding you that the kilonova itself is this isotropic optical emission over the course of roughly a day, a couple days. And then to constrain the inclination of the system We use observations in the X-ray and radio. The way we do that is we assume that there is some relativistic jet coming out from the angular momentum vector of the system. That relativistic jet is Doppler beaming. It hits eventually the ISM, and you get synchrotron radiation, and then you get the jet fanning out, and then it eventually is able to reach the observer over a much longer time scale. So a peak in the X-ray and radio will tell you, as a function of time, will tell you the inclination of the system. And so we did, you've seen this plot already today, I'll just be very brief. Our analysis pretty weakly, but it does exclude on-axis viewing of the system. So this is the distance inclination degeneracy, but here it's H-naught. Here is our priors. We do encompass a wide range of plausible jet widths. We prefer a 15-degree jet width, so you go from the Nature paper in the dotted line to the blue line, for example. But all of our analysis prefers an off-axis system, which pushes your H-naught higher. Okay, so just to summarize, we've talked about a lot in a very short period of time, but the future of DCAM is very exciting. Last season's Kilanova was close and bright, quite fortunately for the sort of a kickstart, a whole new area of science, but the future of these types of events is going to be much further and fainter, and that makes DCAM arguably the most powerful tool in the Southern Hemisphere to find these kinds of events. And we're hoping to get maybe a couple more this year with the doubling of the LIGO sensitivity. As far as supernovae go, I'm showing here W0 WA forecast for our five-year sample. So you've seen the purple and the green, and now this blue dotted line is our forecast. And so we're very excited by analyzing the 2,500 roughly supernovae that we have. We're going to use that to also study a lot of the systematic effects now with large statistics from a single photometric system to study supernova environmental dependencies, to maybe break our sample into pieces, study supernova physics, and so on. And then finally, we're working as fast as possible to get the DES three-year combined probes analysis out. So with that, I'll be happy to take questions.
Very nice talk. So with regards to all the local specific star formation stuff that's been discussed, can you say how can DS constrain that? Can you make local enough measurements?
It's very hard to make a local measurement at redshift 0.8. So it's certainly going to have, we're going to have to look at a trimmed down version of our sample to do some kind of local measurement. We did look at star formation in general, albeit with just GRIZ, and just like the mass, we don't see a strong signal.
Just as a precursor, I'm not sure if that last comment needs translation. You're talking about local specific star formation rate on type 1A supernova host galaxies.
Yeah, right. Local as in angular diameter distance.
Right.
Yeah.
So I want to ask about the Kilanova. I'm not sure I quite followed how you are constraining the observing angle from the time of the X-ray peak there. You don't know where the ISM is that is you're interacting with. Can you walk through that part again?
That's a good question. I think that the sensitivity to the distance of the ISM is relatively low because it's relativistic. So I believe it's marginalized over in the uncertainties of the inclination angle.
Yeah. Can you bring back the plot versus redshift that shows the dip at somewhat higher redshift?
In supernovae?
It was in weak lensing, I think.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is the dominant systematic there?
Well, in this analysis here, calibration is the dominant. It's roughly 30% of our budget. We've sort of grouped it in calibration and then all others. And all others, well, the largest of the others is 31%, is 36%.
Okay, will you be gathering much more data on that in the future?
So calibration doesn't come down easily, and that requires, for us, more observations of standard stars and more standard star modeling. So that is the plan, of course, to get it down for the five-year analysis, but it doesn't just come down naturally.
Yeah. Any other questions? If not, let's thank you.